got 1 minute. 1 minute term.
Is there anybody here I haven't shook your hand and said hi to? I didn't say hi to you? I'm a director of environmental health, and I know the importance of hand washing. Why I washed my hands last week, it was just a great job I did. No. Here we have some alcohol-based stuff. If you have dirt on your hands, it's not worth a damn. But if you don't, it's really great. You gotta squeeze out. Okay. This clock here says 8:35.
Oh, go.
Okay.
I'm on easy.
Okay. Got to put glasses on, so anyway. Okay, welcome everybody again, and to the veterinary public health section on feral cats. I've always thought, and particularly from my time and living in Washington D.C., that all policy decisions have rational, political, and emotional components. And feral cat control and management reflects these components and tends to elicit very passionate responses. And I've received many of these responses in my email box over the last few months. Today's panel will present an approach they support and they advocate. And the whole trap, neuter, vaccinate, release, or you can use other orders of those, is what they will advocate about. And I'd like to note that there are other approaches and options and issues and considerations relative to feral cats. And some of the options include trap and fine homes or confined to non-euthanasia shelters for life. Others just advocate for complete removal of cats as a public health measure. And colleagues in various organizations have said recently they recommend these options, and some of the studies have indicated, and there's studies in the literature, that feral cats kill wildlife, and you can read about that in various places, and that they shouldn't be allowed out there. They're non-indigenous species. Second, that it's not nice to the cats. That's my term. But they'll live a shorter life because they're exposed to nature and cars and those type of things. And then others might say that trap, neuter, release or trap, neuter, vaccinate, release may encourage cat abandonment. I haven't been in the Air Force. I hate to admit this, but we had folks that they loved their pets, but they didn't want to take them to Spain or someplace. And they go, no problem, because my good friends down the street will be watching out for them, so they'll be trapped, neutered, and vaccinated and released. So these are some of the issues, but I'm excited to be able to be here to start some dialogue again, which has been started many places over the nation. And the way this came about is Tom Gasevich got in touch with me. And because of his efforts, we have this wonderful panel here today to present to us. Tom's a public health consultant, but he's also a certified health officer in Massachusetts and a graduate of the Public Health Leadership Institute. He's served as a local health agency director. He is the director of public health there, and he's also an elected member of a board of health, and he's also a member of NACHO's executive board. So you can tell that Tom is a true bureaucrat just like myself. It's my pleasure to have him take over now and moderate the panel, and thank you all for coming. We will encourage you to hold your questions, if you would, towards the end, and what we'd like to do is to have you write your questions down so we can get those down. If there needs to be more information, you know, your name and your email, we can send you out more information. This whole panel is dedicated to information sharing and transfer, and so that's what we like to do. And then after our session's over, they're here for you to talk to, and they'll be here for you to communicate with. Tom, let me see, I don't want you to take your stuff.
Bureaucrat 2 to Bureaucrat 1. Thank you. I also want to thank the committee itself, Sveg, and more so you, the audience, who have an interest or those who want to be educated on both sides of the fence. And that's why we had the picture that we had. And the reason the flyer went out as it was is that public health protection on both. Those who are on the other side of the fence, and we, the humane people, supposedly, who care for them. At least, we all love pets, but when we're not caring for them in our home, we start wondering what's going on the other side of the world. I would like to overly welcome Tomahawk Live Trap. They're here. Their support of us helped get here. And what I mean get here is get the picture. Their traps have been known and supported by the U.S. government. Matter of fact, when they go out with most of their bids, it's their product that's used on the specs for the bids. So I guess you couldn't get a better word than Uncle Sam itself. And Melissa, I just want to thank you for your support. And she has a variety of items over there that as vets or as lay people, you may need for other items. I don't think she could do an elephant, but I think she can design anything for anything else you need. Brian, why don't we start off with you? And I think the best thing would be that every individual will be introduced by the next one. We'll carry through after Brian. We then would go to Cheryl, and then after Cheryl, we go to Gordon. After Gordon, we go to Eric. After Eric, we go to Julie, and then John, and then Taylor. Is that correct? All right. I thank you very much, and at the end, we'll field the questions. We'll take four questions at the end, and any other question, we will respond to, and just give us your email, and we're going to converse back and forth. And the email you'd be using is TomPublicHealth, all one word, all lowercase, TomPublicHealth1@yahoo.com. And hopefully we can keep this dialogue going as Jim wanted us to. Cheryl? Oh, Brian, I'm sorry.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Brian Cortes. I'm the executive director of Neighborhood Cats. It's a group that specializes in feral cat education and advocacy around the country, and we're based in New York City. And before we talk about anything, I think one of the most informative approaches is first just to look at the problem and see what we're dealing with. So in the United States, there's no exact accurate number available, but there are some estimates. And you can see they range from a low of 13 million in the winter to 24 million in summer by one count. Dr. Julie Levy, who's on the panel today, wrote an article in 2004 that estimated 50 million. And then Alley Cat Allies, which is also a national feral cat group, has estimated anywhere from 60 to 100. So obviously that's quite a wide range, but my point is the scope is clearly somewhere in the millions around the country. When we look at feral cat overpopulation, the fields that it primarily impacts are these four: animal sheltering and control, public health, wildlife, and animal welfare. So again, right now we're just trying to look at the consequences of having these millions of feral cats running around the environment. Now, on animal sheltering and control, your impact comes from the fact that you have a very low sterilization rate among feral cats as compared to pet cats. So it's estimated, again by Dr. Levy, that 50 million feral cats would result in 147 million kittens being born each year, which is 82% of the kittens born in this country. So I think that's a startling statistic when you realize 4 out of 5 of the cats that are born in the United States come from the feral cat population. Now, when you have this many kittens flooding animal control shelters, plus you may have a shelter that's actively trapping feral adults. These are the consequences of that. You're going to have higher intake rates into shelters. You're going to run out of room, so your euthanasia rates are going to go up. Your adoption rates relatively are going to go down. So you also have, I'm sure those of you who work in public health and deal with complaint calls, you get an awful lot of complaints about feral cats with nuisance behavior. There's financial costs for the shelter to trap the cat, take the cat in, hold the cat possibly for a mandatory period of time, euthanize the cat, and then dispose of the body. There's also opportunity costs. If you speak to shelter directors in open admission shelters where they can't turn away any animal and they have to take these cats in, and you ask them, well, what would you do if you didn't have to deal with this flood of kittens 2-3 times a year, there's a lot of programs they would rather be funding than spending. Dr. Gordon Stahl will speak about a program in Burlington County, and they estimated at one point they were spending 25% of their sheltering dollars just on the trapping and euthanasia of feral cats. You also have stress to workers in these open admission shelters who are constantly dealing with this high euthanasia rate. On public health specifically, number one, you have rabies concerns. If that's in the environment where you are, feral cats, I know in the Northeast where I'm from, rabies is endemic in the raccoon population. Feral cats tend to habitate in the same environment as the raccoons. So sometimes you get infection of feral cats from the endemic species and then possible exposures to human beings. There are other zoonotic diseases to be concerned about, including toxoplasmosis, cat scratch fever, roundworms, things like that, that can potentially be passed on to people. I do want to note, though, that since we're this is a scientific forum, the only study that's been done on toxoplasmosis found no correlation between the presence of cats in a neighborhood and the incidence of toxoplasmosis. So I think that risk is sometimes overstated, but do want to acknowledge that it exists to at least some degree. Then, of course, public health often has to deal with quality of life complaints that I mentioned, and they have, or you have your own costs if you're investigating these complaints. On wildlife, which Eric Stiles from the New Jersey Audubon Society will discuss in detail, feral cats can predate on wildlife. They can compete for food sources, and in sensitive ecosystems of rare species that are vulnerable to cat attacks, they can potentially have a devastating impact. On animal welfare itself, something Mr. Dale mentioned, it's not a happy scene. We're talking about unmanaged feral cat situations. There's a 50 to 75% mortality rate, and adults tend to have an average, again, we're talking about unneutered, unmanaged situations, a short average lifespan, and they're facing, you know, the numerous dangers that are in the environment. So I want to make the point at the beginning here that the issue, we're trying to change the discussion into something I think that's a little more enlightened. And the issue is not whether having millions of feral cats running around the country is a good thing. Okay, we're acknowledging that it's not. And the real issue is not, is it a good life for feral cats? Should they be there or not be there? The point is, what we need to be discussing is how do we effectively reduce their numbers and mitigate some of these consequences that we've been discussing. Now, when we talk about TNR, the current discussion is, I think, too much about, TNR is not a good thing because feral cats may carry rabies, or feral cats don't live a good life. And that's describing the problem, but it's not addressing what the potential solution is. So we need to talk about solutions and all agree that it's not a great thing to be having them out there. So if you're going to actually do something about it and discuss what can be done, you really have four choices. You can do nothing. Some communities try to institute feeding bans against the feral cats. You can do what I call trap and remove, which usually results in euthanasia. But the most important point is that you're removing them from, or trying to remove them from the environment. And then you have TNR, which is really just a fancy way of saying population control through sterilization and disease control through vaccination. So notice that there isn't a number five, okay? There isn't a magic wand to just make them all go away. You have to do one or some combination of these. Okay, we know that doing nothing doesn't work, and because the habitat remain suitable for feral cats, and the only limit is going to be the carrying capacity of the environment, which can grow as food sources grow. So if you have rising human populations and you're doing nothing, you're going to see probably rising feral cat numbers because the food source is growing. If you have a stable human population, you'll probably year after year have the same number of cats in the environment. And all those issues we discussed are not resolved. And again, saying they shouldn't be there with no affirmative action really amounts to doing nothing. Feeding bans don't work. Number one, if anybody's tried it, they're just utterly unenforceable. I mean, I've seen them attempted in jail situations, paramilitary situations, and they're just, you know, unless you've got somebody following each cat feeder around 24 hours a day, you're not going to be able to stop people. It's also very difficult to remove food sources. I guess the theory is that if you take away the food, the cats will either go away or starve to death, but they actually stay and they continue to reproduce. And what happens is they become malnourished and they become more susceptible to fleas and other parasitic infestations. And the situation, if you can deprive them of food, actually tends to get much worse. Removing them doesn't work because, number one, there's too many of them at this point and not enough animal control resources to effectively remove enough of them. I think the situation we're in speaks to that as a failed solution. We wouldn't have millions of feral cats running around if removing them was something that worked. You also have resistance from the people who are taking care of the cats. You have a vacuum effect where if you remove cats from an environment, but it's the habitat's still suitable for their survival, other cats will come in and begin the cycle all over again. You have ongoing abandonment and a lack of long-term monitoring. And then you have a synergistic effect of all these factors going on at the same time. And I just want to mention in passing that the notion that in a TNR colony that you have increased abandonment is something that I've never seen any data to support that. That's, at this point, just a truism. These are fantasy solutions. The notion that you can socialize and adopt enough of the millions of cats out to make a difference, or you could put them in sanctuaries, you can only do that with a very, very small percentage of these cats. These are very difficult and time-consuming. And they're also just forms of removal, and you run into all the problems that I mentioned before. You can talk about cat licensing and leash laws. The problem is those may help reduce the inflow of cats in the future, but they're not going to do anything about the millions and millions of feral cats that are already out there. So what is TNR? You're trapping the members of a feral colony. You're neutering them, plus rabies vaccination and ear tipping at a minimum. Ear tipping is a form of identifying a neutered cat. You're returning the cats to their original site, and then ideally there's a long-term, what we always try to stress is there's some type of long-term caretaking and monitoring of the colony. So somebody's there to address changed circumstances. What are the advantages? Well, number one, nothing else works. You can engage a great deal of volunteer manpower that you can't get with removal efforts. If the private sector is involved, it's a lot less costly for government. You get caretakers to work with you instead of against you. You do have that long-term monitoring, and you're not creating vacuums, especially if you're doing the sterilization in a wide enough area. There are some empirical examples of TNR success. Dr. Levy will discuss some academic examples. Newburyport, Massachusetts had 300 cats on their waterfront in 1991. That's a seacoast town off the Atlantic in Massachusetts. They were the first community in this country to do TNR on a wide scale. So they reached, the first year they trapped 200 of the 300, adopted out 100. That's often something that comes out of these TNR situations is a wholesale removal in the beginning for adoptive purposes. They returned 100, they reached 100% sterilization in 1998, and today they have one cat left on the waterfront. And that's, I say, 35 feeders for this one cat. Now, one of the things that's instructive about Newburyport is that by getting their feral population under control and basically eliminated, then they were able to divert their resources into where did these cats come from in the first place. They opened a local shelter, and that helped reduce abandonment, and they opened a free spay-neuter clinic, which also helped cut off the source. So once we get past this crisis stage, then we can really effectively address the root issues. Another example is the New York City Feral Cat Database. That's an online system that we run in New York City where caretakers self-reporting information by caretakers. As of July, we had 458 colonies with at least one TNR cat. There were over 6,000 cats reported when people began TNR, and today, as of July, there were 4,600. That's a 25% average decline within each colony at an average spay-neuter rate of 67%. So we have shown, I think, some demonstrable reduction through TNR. Other community examples include San Francisco, which included TNR as a part of a comprehensive cat overpopulation program in the 1990s. They were actually paying people $5 to bring in feral cats to get fixed. And they saw a intake drop by 28% and euthanasia for all cats dropped by over 70%. Indianapolis has done over 10,000 feral spay neuters from October 2004 through December 2007. They work very closely with their animal control. They saw a drop in intake of 37%. Euthanasia was down 29%. Long Beach, New York, Neighborhood Cats runs a small program there. It's a moderate-sized community, about 30,000 people. Just doing 400 feral spay neuters since April 2005 in a targeted manner has led to a live cat intake drop in local shelters of 62%. There is also legislation that enabling TNR in these communities. It's no longer this fringe concept. It's embraced by a variety of different communities. Las Vegas, Nevada was just the most recent to pass a TNR ordinance. And finally, let me show you, for those of you who don't know what an ear-tipped cat looks like, there's one. Okay, so thank you very much, and I'm going to pass this on now to Cheryl Macaroni, who works in New Jersey.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to speak to you about the development of trap, neuter, and return policy in New Jersey. As the former director of the Office of Animal Welfare, which is in the New Jersey State Department of Health and Senior Services, which is a cabinet-level position at the state level, I am extremely excited to tell you about what took place in New Jersey. So, why care about feral cats? Well, there are several reasons why you should care about feral cats. We all know that if feral cats are not sterilized, the population increases. Properly vaccinated feral cats promotes public health. It's very costly to trap and euthanize feral cats. It is possible to implement a feral cat policy that protects wildlife. TNR humanely controls feral cat populations. And at the state level, you should care because the state is in the best position to help develop a uniform policy on TNR. So in New Jersey, we found that many groups and agencies had an interest in TNR. So who were these stakeholders? There were health officials, animal control officers, pounds and shelters, wildlife officials and advocates, companion animal advocates, and veterinarians. And what were these stakeholders' concerns? We found that for health officials, they were concerned about rabies and other zoonotic diseases. Companion animal advocates wanted non-lethal methods to manage and reduce the populations. Animal control officers expressed how difficult and costly it was to trap. For pounds and shelters, the challenges that they faced were holding the cats for 7 days. In New Jersey, there is a law that for impounding a non-owned animal, it must be held for 7 days. For wildlife officials and advocates, their priority was the protection of rare, threatened, and endangered species. And with veterinarians, the challenge was to enlist their help to provide low-cost services. So, how do you deal with all these stakeholders and all their concerns? Well, in New Jersey, we already had an innovative structure in place. It was called the Office of Animal Welfare. It was created in 2004 by the Commissioner of Health and Senior Services, which is a cabinet-level position, and the mission was to work in partnership with stakeholders to promote animal health and welfare. We also educated the public and government agencies on animal health and welfare. So what were the benefits of having this Office of Animal Welfare at the state level in the Department of Health? Uniformity. You're at the state level. You have centralization. Coordination. New Jersey has 566 municipalities. The resources at the state level are much greater than at the local level. You also had statewide authority in many instances. Now, before the Office of Animal Welfare, the approach to ferals was that there was no real statewide policy. As I mentioned, New Jersey has 566 municipalities, so therefore it was very hard to get uniformity with all those municipalities. So, what did the Office of Animal Welfare do with regard to the stakeholders and their concerns? Well, one of the first things we did was we gathered data. We studied all the relevant issues. We looked at what were the applicable statutes and regulations. We looked at cat licensing. In New Jersey, about 328 municipalities have cat licensing out of the 566 municipalities. We looked at the quality of life issues for ferals. We looked at, was there an impact on the environment? We looked at, were ferals, what was the impact with regard to wildlife? And also, what was the impact on public health? And we did more research. We looked at sterilization of all these cats. We looked at overcrowding at pounds and shelters. We looked at animal control agencies, their funding and their operating expenses. We looked at, were there dedicated revenue sources in order to provide low-cost sterilization? We also looked at particular studies that were able to reduce population by using the TNR method. We also looked at how to educate the public with regard to preventing cat abandonment and the consequences of not fixing ferals. So after all of this gathering of the data and doing all this research, we decided that it was time to host the dialogue. The Office of Animal Welfare convened a symposium, and we invited all the stakeholders. Again, the health officials, the animal control officers, the animal welfare advocates, the wildlife officials and advocates, and all other interested parties. And what we did was we asked them to present their positions and to really talk and to really listen to each other. And out of that dialogue and many, many meetings, the New Jersey Feral Cat Wildlife Coalition was born. And you will be hearing about more of that from the other panelists. So, successful strategies. What the Office of Animal Welfare found was that in order to develop a successful TNR policy, you must gather all the stakeholders. You must identify, study, and discuss all the relevant issues. Develop a written policy. Create a pilot program. In New Jersey, a pilot program was created. It was called, and is still called, the Burlington County Cat Initiative. And you will hear more about that from another panelist in a moment. You also must monitor and reevaluate your pilot program as it progresses. So, lessons learned. What did the state of New Jersey learn with regard to consulting with the stakeholders, listening to them, hosting a dialogue? We learned that sometimes you have to rethink. Sometimes the traditional way of doing things doesn't work. You have to be open to other ideas, other suggestions. You have to lead with vision. And the state was in a perfect opportunity to do that with having the Office of Animal Welfare. You must work together. It's not going to happen if all the groups, all the various stakeholders don't work together. Identify your common goals. For instance, both the TNR advocates and the wildlife advocates are seeking to reduce and eliminate pet abandonment and feral cat populations. That's their common goal. We both want the same thing. You have to build consensus. And you can do it. It is possible to bring groups with diverse interests together and through a respective dialogue and recognition of all the stakeholders' interests, you can create an effective and humane TNR policy. And I thank you. I do have one official disclaimer that the views expressed by me are my own views and don't necessarily reflect the Office of the Attorney General, the Department of law and public safety, or any other state agency. Thank you.
My name is Eric Stiles. I'm the Vice President of Conservation with New Jersey Audubon, and in the interest of full disclosure, I am not a major stakeholder in Halliburton. So, I will be sharing a PowerPoint that is really developed on behalf of our coalition in New Jersey. Just want to stress that prior to this, the wildlife community, with myself as a vociferous advocate, had a very novel approach, which was just offering the adage of no. Without a solution. That is, TNR was not appropriate, and as Brian Cortez said, Eric, basically in a kind way, where's your magic wand? What is the solution? And I think I've learned quite a bit thanks to my fellow presenters. So again, we're going to talk about an approach. An endangered species, it's a risk categorization of conservation biologists. That is, there's not many of them left, and there's a high risk chance that they will be disappearing in the near to midterm. We've heard about some of the potential unintended consequences on wildlife. They compete for limited resources with mid-sized mammals like raccoons and opossums and skunks. They predate others. There's the potential unintended consequences of there's various state and federal pieces of legislation that regulate harassment, harm-taking of these native species. I just want to stress, though, that not all species are created equally in regards to their vulnerability to predation. What you see in the bottom left is a recently hatched piping plover. It's a beach nesting bird on the Atlantic coast of New Jersey. They look about the size of little cotton balls with toothpick legs, are highly vulnerable and susceptible to predation. They are an endangered species. So the nexus of two cultures, as Cheryl articulated, at least from where I sit, wildlife groups are very concerned and passionate about the fate of wildlife, and I think that's shared by both cultures. Both cultures recognize that cats are the victims of irresponsible human behavior. I mean, so are endangered species for that point. You know, we've kind of put them at that place. We could buy into the idea of reducing the suffering and death of feral cats, thereby reducing the suffering and death of native wildlife. In order to move forward, there's two approaches to advocacy. One is scorched earth, winner takes all, high stakes and often ineffective. The other is collaborative in nature, where you're willing to reach across the aisle, build bridges, find those common grounds. And I think that's what we had to offer. Leave behind whose science is better. Also acknowledge that TNR is appropriate in places and other places, again, for example, next to a piping plover, beach location may not be the best and most suitable option. So again, what we came up with is a pilot. Thank you to Dr. Gordon Stull for really being the sweat equity behind road testing this. We are constantly revising this to make sure it's both efficient and effective. We're in this process. We take a look at using online mapping that is available at the state level, the distribution of rare species habitat, and its proximity to proposed trap-neuter return colonies. This is no different than how municipalities or counties engage in land use decisions. Taking a look at how two things are located or co-located in space and time, and you make informed decisions about that. And so this is very, very based on a 100-year-old, 200-year-old premise going back to Napoleon, in regards to how we make land use decisions. So in New Jersey, we're fortunate. We have this online mapping that Dr. Stull and his team have been trained in its usage, that you can zoom in to any location within the state and take a look at the distribution of critical habitat. So what we see here identified in yellow is a municipality where my caretaker's cottage is the only affordable housing option, Bernardsville, New Jersey. So you zoom into that municipality and then you turn on critical habitat. Anything that's in color here is considered to be critical habitat for rare, threatened, endangered species. Again, we have not begun discerning those which are vulnerable versus those which are not. Anything in gray is outside of those critical habitat zones. This is another example. So I live in a semi-rural suburban community. This is Jersey City, right across from downtown Manhattan. As you can see, there's almost no areas that light up in this case. So again, the distribution of habitat is very landscape and geographic specific. Those red circles you see are peregrine falcons that nest on bridges and buildings. We're not too worried about that. Parenthetically, the green area, which is adjacent to the Hudson River, is an endangered ground nesting hawk. That would be a species that we would be concerned about, making sure that we took that into consideration. So we have developed a pilot ordinance and technical manual, our coalition. When I say we, it's not New Jersey Audubon, it is our coalition that has developed a multi-step approach. The first is, the first is to consult with the map that I just showed you. The second step would be if you consult with the map and there's no habitat within a quarter of a mile of the proposed location, there's no further review required for wildlife. The next potential outcome is there's habitat present but no vulnerable species. For example, if there's a bald eagle nest, which is still state endangered, that would light up as a habitat patch, but you're not worried about the feral cats eating the bald eagle. Maybe the reverse relationship. So again, there would be no need for further review in regards to that consideration. Another potential outcome is that habitat is present, vulnerable species are present, but the caretaker decides to use a non-TNR approach. That could be relocation of the colony, removal of the colony, or on-site confinement. Or, as with all land use decisions, under private property rights, you can challenge the accuracy of the state's information. So, for example, it's predicated on 2002 land use. Well, there may be a Walmart there where it had been a forest. Not that that ever happens in New Jersey. The next approach, which is actually the most common, I mean, I want to stress that, this 95% plus of the occurrences thus far fall into this category where the species is present, but we still move forward with trap neuter return. Again, most species, for example, the box turtle, the juvenile box turtles, may be susceptible to predation, but as I think Brian and Dr. Stahl and Cheryl would say, before we had no management, and now they are being managed. And that's preferable. And as a wildlife biologist, it's good to know. We have hard data on the number of cats in this colony and what that attrition curve looks like over time. We also recognize that there are parks throughout New Jersey, urban parks, that are managed at least in part for wildlife watching. So this, again, creates a construct that forces dialogue between the TNR caretaker, I hate to use force, but that's the outcome, and the park manager. So again, everything you see is this iterative dialogue process. There we go. The other is nuisance complaints. Backyard bird feeding and wildlife watching. I have a 4-year-old son, Nathaniel, and as my wife said, if he was the first, he'd be the only, and my 7-year-old daughter. And we spent a lot of time looking at those birds in our backyards. And if there were cats coming through that my backyard, that would be a very, and I do have two cats, they're indoor cats, but that would be a very important issue to us as a quality of life issue. So again, this forces the dialogue, instead of going through nuisance complaints, which had been the traditional route, it's more of a dispute resolution where the town would sit down with both parties and try and come up with an acceptable solution. So the current status is that, thanks again to Dr. Stahl's sweat equity, we have gone through the initial review process. We are fine-tuning that to make more efficient use of his excellent time in this review process. And I just want to stress that initial outcomes would say of the myriads of colonies out there, there's only a handful that we really want to engage in further review. Red-headed woodpeckers and endangered species that feed on the ground, for example. But most of the information is great. We have biological, robust data that we can track over time for taking a look at how these populations change within the colonies. So I just want to stress that from the vantage point of wildlife community, I think as Brian and Cheryl have said, the answer of no to TNR is not a vision. It's a firm, hard, fast position. It doesn't get you anywhere in dialogue, nor do animal welfare folks that say TNR is best and most appropriate everywhere. And so I think you've seen an informed dialogue. It is robustly grounded, I think, in best principles and practices from veterinary, public health, and wildlife, and again, I want to stress for wildlife folks that say this shouldn't occur, one of the, Jim Collins, I think, wrote about this, the social sector, said basically if you're in the business of change and all you do is advocate a position of no and the world isn't any different from your actions, you need to get a different career or a different job. And so if we sit here and just engage in antagonistic relationships, it's not good governance, the cats nor the wildlife benefit. So for folks that are passionate about wildlife, I would challenge you, and I would welcome this dialogue, to come up with a better solution. Because I sure as heck haven't found one, and I'm very excited about this partnership and collaboration. And now it's my proud honor to introduce Dr. Gordon Stahl, who has really put, is where the rubber meets the road, which is implementing this great community-based program throughout Burlington County in New Jersey.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Stahl. I'm the director of the Burlington County Feral Cat Initiative, an on-the-ground program. We have currently seven municipalities in our 40-municipality county engaged in this feral cat TNR program. Burlington County is a county of about 450,000 people. Our health department estimates there to be between 50 and 70,000 feral cats. This estimate deeply concerns the health department because over several decades and significant efforts at trap and remove and considerable financial resources, they have not been successful in curtailing this population increase, and it continues to increase despite their efforts. Furthermore, Burlington County, New Jersey, has the highest incidence of rabies of all New Jersey counties. This, coupled with the fact that feral cats represent the largest unvaccinated feral cat population, and we know that feral cats live outdoors, adjacent to, and perhaps interacting with wildlife, creates a perfect storm potential. And the county is quite concerned about this possibility and has, as a result, been looking for alternatives and has endorsed our TNR program, looking for alternatives to both control population as well as help to control rabies incidents. Over the, out of this failed trap and remove effort by the county has been born the Burlington County Feral Cat Initiative. With the endorsement of the Burlington County Health Department and the Burlington County Board of Chosen Freeholders and a generous grant from Geraldine R. Dodge, we're able to offer free TNR to several municipalities who are willing to give TNR a chance to prove itself in controlling feral cat population as well as dealing with other feral cat issues. Furthermore, we were concerned about stakeholder issues regarding the concerns of other individuals regarding feral cats, and we made every effort to understand and address the issues of the stakeholder groups. The stakeholders involved in this feral cat issue would be the health department, various municipality issues, wildlife conservationists, and feral cat caregivers and feral cats. I'd like to take briefly each of these stakeholders and in turn discuss briefly some of their issues. For the past 12 years before the introduction of our program, the Burlington County Health Department was who was responsible for running and financing shelter operations, the county shelter operations, had been noticing a continuing and significant increase in feral and stray cat intake at the shelter. This translated to increased taxpayer costs. The cost for per cat at the county shelter to hold for the mandatory 7-day holding period and then euthanize each cat was approximately $130. Parenthetically, the cost to TNR each cat is less than half that price. So multiplying the cost per cat by the average number of cats, feral and stray cats intake taken in at the shelter, we're talking about close to $500,000 a year in program costs just to deal with feral cat issues. Maybe on Wall Street this is pocket change, but for counties this is real money, and it certainly gave incentive to the county and the health department to look for alternatives and give TNR a chance. Regarding municipalities, the stakeholder issues are primarily animal control costs, nuisance complaints, issues of public safety, and the public perception of animal control. Since most nuisance complaints are related to feral cat mating behaviors, yowling and fighting, as soon as the animals are neutered, most of these complaints go away, and with them, significant reduction in animal control costs. Public safety issues are related primarily to zoonotic diseases, the most important being rabies, and of course, a mandatory rabies vaccination in our program addresses that issue. People are very unhappy about a program that will allow animals to be picked up by animal control and be routinely brought to the shelter and euthanized, as is the case with trap and remove programs. Much more acceptable to the public are a more humane approach where attrition is the primary, attrition and rehoming are the primary methods of resulting in feral cat population reduction. Eric Stiles gave a wonderful presentation on wildlife conservation and feral cats. We're very concerned about the possible predation of feral cats on wildlife, and are working closely with the Feral Cat and Wildlife Coalition and the development of protocols to protect protected species. And as Mr. Stiles told us, the Burlington County Animal Shelter, the Burlington County Feral Cat Initiative is currently involved in a pilot program to test these protocols. Most feral cats are unneutered and unvaccinated, and this is what we find when we go to a new colony. In addition, we find a caregiver who is basically overwhelmed, unable to do much for the cats other than feed them, and not really very knowledgeable about feral cat management, colony management. So in exchange for a promise by that caregiver to take care of this colony for the lifetime of the colony, we offer free TNR and training in proper feral care, colony management. It's not long after the cats in that colony are TNR'd that both the cats and the caregiver are in much better shape. So after a two-year retrospective of our program, we found that more than 99% of the cats in our program were vaccinated, rabies vaccinated, and neutered, and that there was an average reduction of approximately 26% in each colony population. We further found there to be a statistically significant decrease in shelter feral cat intake as related to those municipalities that are in our program versus municipalities in Burlington County that are not in our program. So given a choice, it would seem that looking at stakeholder issues and efficacy, TNR is clearly the method of choice for feral cat population control. Thank you very much. I would like to introduce, and I'm proud to introduce Dr. Julie Levy, who has done marvelous work on feral cat medicine.
There are a number of zoonotic diseases and other infectious issues involved with the feral cat problem, and in our short time today, we don't have adequate time to discuss all of the existing literature that deals with cat zoonotic diseases. So I'm going to focus on rabies because we do consider it to be, although extremely uncommon, the most important zoonotic problem that veterinarians are responsible for controlling. I'm a professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Florida and have recently left the internal medicine department to start a shelter medicine program there. If we want to take a look at what has been evolving in the international setting for rabies control, it's very instructive in terms of how free-roaming community animals can be a source of rabies and how we can control them without trying to eliminate the animals, because the public has a very intense affection for these animals. Internationally, dog rabies is the primary strain that affects people, and more than 55,000 people die of rabies each year, mostly children. This is mostly in Asia and Africa. These communities have large numbers of free-roaming dogs, but they're community dogs or village dogs. They're not necessarily owned by a family, but they are owned by the village, and the village does feel a protective sentiment about many of these animals. And rabies obviously is controlled by vaccination and dog control, and this is a vaccine clinic in Africa. So the World Health Organization has taken this into consideration and has been studying for a number of years what the best approach to rabies control in these developing nations is. And what these are quotes from their policy statement about rabies control and free-roaming dogs. They say that there is no evidence that removal of dogs alone has ever had a significant impact on dog population densities or the spread of rabies. And this is very important because proposals that we just remove the cats as a solution are likely to be ineffective. Population turnover of dogs may be so high that even the highest recorded removal rates are easily compensated by increased survival rates. And this is certainly true for cats. They can reproduce extremely rapidly, and this is actually a challenge for us even in surgical control because the animals that we've missed are overcoming some of our efforts at a very rapid rate. In addition, the dog removal may be unacceptable in local communities. This is also what we find in the United States. The public has affection for these cats, and we've done surveys of caretakers, and some of them even say, I don't like cats, and I don't own cats, but I go to the store and buy cat food because this mother cat showed up in my backyard with her litter, and I couldn't stand to see them starve. And this is the sentiment that we have to incorporate into our public policy. So the WHO suggests that the control program for rabies should include immunization of all dogs and cats owned by an individual or by the community. Reduce the size of the ownerless dog population by reproductive control, reduction of the carrying capacity of the environment, and law enforcement when needed. And I think this is a very sound policy that we should try to build into our feral cat control policy in the United States. I'm going to review just a few publications on this topic that have been published in the last few years. This was a very interesting report on canine rabies control in India. Historically, in this community, dogs have been controlled by periodic poisoning, and that would decrease the population momentarily, but then the survivors would be more healthy and reproduce themselves and reconstitute the population. In 1994, an animal birth control program for unowned neighborhood free-roaming and feral dogs was instituted by a charity. And they didn't just neuter everything. They actually were quite targeted to make the best use of their resources. So they targeted all female dogs because from a population control point of view, it is the female that matters. There's always a male out there, and for a village, that's all you need. They also targeted immature male dogs, and this is because this population was most likely to be involved in biting, especially with children. And we know that neutering reduces aggression in dogs. So they did they call it capture, neuter, return. They ear-notched and tattooed all the dogs, neutered them, and gave them a single rabies vaccine at the time of surgery. So the outcome over this time period, they neutered over 19,000 dogs. 86% of the neutered dogs were females. And over that time span, the dog population decreased by 28%. And this graph shows the change in human rabies cases. This The red line is the part of the city that did not have an animal birth control program in it, and we see that human rabies either stayed the same or slightly increased, and the blue line is the human rabies cases in the part of the city that had the animal birth control program. And in the last several years of this program, there have been no human rabies cases. And as you all are expertly aware, this is just a horrific disease, and this is a huge advancement both for animal welfare and for human welfare. So bringing us back to the United States, these are the recent statistics released by the CDC about rabies in the animal rabies in the United States. And we see that virtually all of our rabies cases are in wildlife because dog rabies was eliminated in control programs in the 1950s. And so domestic species are shown here in the green line. And if we zero in then on those domestic species, the cat in red is what concerns us because we now have more rabid cats in the United States than rabid dogs. And why does this occur? Oops. Cats are now the most numerous species that are owned as pets, and so it would make sense that we would have proportional increase in disease in those animals. Many pet cats are either kept exclusively outdoors or allowed to roam outdoors where they can mingle with wildlife. Also, it's known that pet cats are less likely to see veterinarians and have current veterinary care than dogs are. Sadly, still in the United States, many jurisdictions, even whole states, do not require rabies vaccination for cats, and I think this is a great group to raise the call that we have universal rabies vaccines for cats in the continental United States. And there are many unowned free-roaming cats which escape veterinary care altogether. So our questions are, can trap, neuter, return reduce both the cat population and the threat of rabies in the United States? Feral cats are the uncounted statistic. Brian gave some nice summaries of the literature trying to estimate the numbers of cats. When we talk about cats, there's pet cats, stray cats, and feral cats. I tend to lump stray cats and feral cats together when I'm talking about numbers of cats because they're frequently in the same colonies and they will congregate and reproduce just as much. So the personality of the cat does not distinguish whether it's eligible for our programs or not. Just being unowned is, and depending on who you believe, somewhere between 10 and 90 million stray and feral cats are roaming the United States right now receiving no veterinary care. As we've heard, this is an international problem. Internationally, there are adverse impacts on public health, the environment, and animal welfare, but also internationally, people who feed these cats are very affectionate and protective of them. This is a man in Italy feeding his cats in the park that he does every day. In the United States, 8 to 12% of U.S. households feed free-roaming cats they say they don't own. So this is a very, very common procedure across the country. We have to consider this public sentiment when we develop public policy. So have you heard the goals of trap, neuter, return are non-lethal population reduction, leading to healthier and safer cats, lower adverse impacts, and reduced public complaints from the community. And the methods are variable. Different programs have different levels of care, but basically the minimum level of care should be live trapping, neutering, ear tipping, and this also shows the ear tip removed from a cat, which identifies it as a neutered cat. Internationally, this is a recognized symbol. Rabies vaccination, and then euthanasia of ill cats. If cats are too sick to be returned to the environment, they should be either held for treatment or euthanized. But the main thing is, if we're talking about millions of cats or within a community, tens of thousands of cats, these programs have to be massive in nature. We have to make very hard decisions about cost benefits and narrow the focus on neutering as many cats as possible. This is a report from the University of Central Florida near Orlando, and these folks kind of invented TNR. They didn't know it was a possibility in the early 90s, and they just started neutering the cats on campus. They were staff there. And by 1996, they'd identified all the cats on campus. At that time, there was about 70 cats. And what you can see in this nicely managed private TNR program, whoops, is that the population has just steadily decreased, and now they're down to, as of now, less than 10 cats, and they're all quite geriatric. So is it feasible and affordable to scale up? I think we've shown very well that it's quite effective for a well-run program to focus on an individual colony or institution, control the cats and the nuisance on that area, but can we scale this up to the community level? Because that's been more challenging. Using my community as an example, Lacho County, Florida, there's 225,000 residents. We did a survey showing that there were 43,000 pet cats and 36,000 stray and feral cats that were being fed by people. We don't know how many cats were there that were not being fed. And in our county, over the last 10 years, there's been 128 rabid animals diagnosed, of which there were two dogs and one cat. The cat was actually a pet cat diagnosed just this past July that had not been vaccinated. At the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, we run a TNR program once a month. It has multiple purposes. Our primary purpose is a humane one, to reduce the population of feral cats by neutering, but also it gives our veterinary students a great opportunity to hone their surgery skills. And many of our students will graduate having performed hundreds of spays, which for y'all who went to vet school when I did, you knew that wasn't the typical amount of surgical experience that you finished school with. Costs us about $25 a cat. It is all volunteer, but our total costs come to about this. We've neutered 25,000 cats in the past 10 years. This is what it looks like. This is our student surgery training area, and we are allowed to use this space once a month. It's kind of a mass unit, and the cats progress through the stations. This is the number of cats that we've done each year. We always do a few more females, and that's noticed around the country as a common activity, and that's good because it really is the females that matter for population control. And interestingly now, because we did over 4,000 cats last year, that our feral cat TNR program is the biggest provider of rabies vaccinations in the whole county. We vaccinate more than any single veterinary clinic and more than the county animal shelter does. So another report is a collaboration between the University of Florida and Alachua County Animal Services, our county municipal shelter. We wanted to know if we could target a zip code that had a high rate of admission of cats to animal control for neutering and actually impact the number of animals coming to animal control. This is what we saw. We've just recently finished this, and I don't have a lot of data, but the blue line is the intake of cats in the non-target area, and the red line is the intake of cats in our zip code that had a big problem. We saw that we did see a much more dramatic decrease by going into the community and neutering the cats, and this saves the county quite a bit of money. So what about rabies vaccination in feral cats? Do they really need to be vaccinated? Are they highly susceptible? And is it feasible to administer a vaccine under the stress of capture and surgery and expect it to be effective? And if you haven't actually met a feral cat up close, this is usually the greeting that you get. So duration of immunity in cats following rabies vaccination, this is important because we know that on a regulatory basis, the first vaccine we give is only good for, or can only give a certificate for 1 year, and it's very hard to retrap these cats for boosters. We do offer free boosters to our caretakers, but very few of them take advantage of it. So in 1981, it was shown that a single rabies vaccine protects cats against challenge for more than 4 years. And then recently, their Continuum vaccine from InterVet has actually been licensed for 4 year duration of immunity. And what they did was vaccinated kittens, and then they challenged them at 50 months, so after that single vaccine. And what we see on the panel on the left is a rapid increase in rabies titer in these cats that persisted for more than 4 years. And then at the challenge, we saw 100% efficacy against virulent challenge compared to very low survival in the control group. So this tells us our vaccines certainly do last a lot longer than they're generally labeled for. But we then wanted to know if we could vaccinate the cat while it was under anesthesia for surgery, would it work as well? So we trapped cats, put them through our program. We had 61 feral cats that had their routine care, and then we retrapped them 2 to 3 months later for serology. The serology was done at Kansas State. The normal adequate titer at Kansas State is greater than 5, but we set our bar to be 25 just to be very certain that we were accurate. What we saw is we had virtually no animals with titers prior to immunization, and then very high average titers later. And if we looked at the percentage of cats that had adequate titers, or greater than 25, we had only one cat out of the 61 that did not acquire an adequate titer. And this is the same percentage of animals that fail to develop adequate titers in the pet animals that are immunized for international travel. So even though these cats are under an awful lot of stress, during the TNR program, they respond excellently to vaccination. So, in conclusion, high-volume TNR is feasible, affordable, and very popular with citizens. It can lead to sustained reductions in cat populations, which is the goal of all stakeholders involved in this dilemma. A high proportion of feral cats admitted to TNR in a rabies endemic region do not have protective antibody titers, and we know that they're mingling with wildlife. Feral cats do have excellent serological responses when vaccinated once at the time of sterilization surgery. And so we conclude that large-scale TNR programs should be developed and should provide rabies vaccinations at the time of surgery using products labeled for at least 3 years' duration of immunity. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is John Cicente. I'd like to thank you all for coming, and to say it's an honor to be here with these members of this panel that are such great experts in this area. My topic is to talk about local boards of health as the policy setters in your community. Nope, that was great. Oh, they are. Great. Thanks. Doing good. I have to do a presented disclosure. I'm also the president of Career Development Institute, and we run state-certified training in animal control officer, animal cruelty investigation, and we have a certificate program in TNR. Now, as you can see from this, I've spent an awful lot of time on local boards of health. I've been on the South Brunswick, president of the South Brunswick Board of Health for 22 years. I've been I'm presently a board member of the New Jersey Local Boards of Health Association, a former president of the New Jersey Local Boards of Health Association, and the former president of the National Association of Local Boards of Health, which kind of makes me a glutton for punishment. But since none of these are paid positions, you know, I've become a professional volunteer. But what it does do is at least qualifies me a little bit to talk about boards of health and their powers and authority and how they can work as a body that will assist implementation of programs. The goals of what I'd like to speak about today, basically, are I want you to understand the role and authority of a local board of health, okay, how you can work with these local boards of health in order to achieve whatever goals you may have, and stress the need for adequate training to make a program workable and to make it acceptable. First, who are members of local boards of health? Well, members of local boards of health are usually citizens either elected or appointed by the governing bodies in a community. I always used to say that they're either an elected official or related to an elected official. You know, it's local government at its best. But honestly, most of the people that are involved on local boards of health are people that are truly interested in health, the health of the community. It's not exactly a stepping stone to the state senate or to the governorship or anything. It's usually a group of dedicated people. Some states require that you have a veterinarian on the board. Some states you also have to have a medical doctor or a nurse. In New Jersey, there's no requirements. They select people like me that have no training in public health. Now, one of the things that a Board of Health does is it sets public health policy. These are the people that determine whether you're going to do TNR or not. They hire and fire the health officer. The health officer is the chief officer in a health department. They're the ones that determine who their employees are going to be. They ensure the public health standards. Usually every state has regulations and rules that have to be implemented. It's their responsibility to ensure that those rules are implemented. They establish the budget, and one of the things they do is pass ordinances. This is in about 47 of the states that in the United States have these local boards of health. They can pass any ordinance they want, just as if they're the governing body, as long as it relates to public health. 13 years ago, my community passed an ordinance in South Brunswick Township saying that all cats had to be licensed. That was it. We just decided at a meeting to do it. If we decide we want TNR, we can decide that. These are the people that are the ones that you need to talk to get whatever programs you want implemented. They also serve another role. They're the representatives of a community. They're supposed to represent the citizens of that county, that town, that municipality, whatever it might be, that village. However they're representative, whoever they represent, they're supposed to represent their needs, their desires. They're supposed to serve as their eyes and ears of the community. Most of the staff that we have, public health staff, they're working all day. Some don't even live in the same community. So we serve as members of a local board of health to say, hey, there's a problem over here in the community. We have this problem with cats over here. We have a problem here. Whatever it might be, we go to our health offices and at our board meetings, we say, we got this issue that needs to be addressed. Okay. And then we go back to the community and we act as agents, spreading the news about health programs that we have, okay, in the community. One of the things we just did is we sent out a flyer about all the resources we have in our health department, and this could be done in any kind of like a TNR training program or TNR education program in the community. We enclosed them with a regular water bill that's sent out every quarter to people in our town. Didn't cost any more money for the town to do it. But when they got this, they got additional information about the services available. They interact with community organizations, members of the local board of health that may be members of the VFW, the Elks. Maybe they're in different church groups, whatever it might be. So they also act as to interact with those groups and get them involved in whatever policies and process that you want. They advocate for public health and public health funding programs. A lot of times, if the health officer goes to a township committee meeting, a governing body, the mayor, and says, oh, I need more money from my department, it's going to sound like they're building their own nest, building their empire. But if a member of the community, a member of the Board of Health, who was appointed by the mayor or elected, an elected official, goes and says, we need more money, it gives us much more credibility for our health department. Oh, we need this program, okay, as opposed to the professionals that are hired. We all know the mayor and the township committee or the county supervisors on a first-name basis usually. So we can say, this is what we need. So they're great advocates for you. Okay, most of, as you know, traditionally, the issues of public health fall under, obviously, the Health Department and Board of Health. It's a long history of animal control from the beginning, with zoonotic diseases, starting with rabies. It's a history of public health being the center of any kind of public health, any kind of a zoonotic disease program. They were concerned about diseases related to animals, disposal, rabies control. It's a traditional public health role. And one of the things that we deal with is public perceptions about programs. How does the public perceive what's going on? You have to, as an advocate or as a member of the community, if you want to get something done, you have to take a look at how people perceive things. How do they perceive cats? How do they perceive TNR? It's a big education process that members of local boards of health can facilitate. You have to, if you're involved in the community, one of the things that was spoken about was some of the financial issues. Every member of a local board of health and every governing body, especially now, are going to be tight worrying about financial issues. We're going to have a decreased revenues the way the economy is going. So what do? You go up there and you talk about how to save money. And one of the ways of saving money has been presented here is perhaps initiating a TNR program in a community. There's a lot of different ways to sell this program. There's a lot of different ways to get what you want done. But I want you to be aware that one of the key agents that you need to bring about that change that you want is by going through your local board of health. I always say to people, it's not going to do any good if we're all talking to each other. We have to talk to the people that are the decision makers, that are the policy makers. Okay. Training, which is one of my areas of interest, obviously. I believe that you really have to, if you want to implement any kind of a program, you have to have proper training. And there's several reasons. Obviously, there's liability issues. If somebody makes a mistake, there's always the issue of liability. If you make partnerships with governing agencies and bodies or private agencies, they have to be concerned with liability. But there's also the perception that you want to make sure that your people are professional and doing it right, that they're dressed appropriately, that they look appropriate, that they know what to do and how to do things. So when they see these operations, the public are impressed. So they say, boy, these are real professionals doing their job. And you're not going to do that without some adequate training. And that goes not just for TNR, but it goes for any kind of animal control that you're involved with. You want to make sure that everybody is adequately trained. What you need to do is you go back when you start these programs, don't forget, well, we can do this, we can do that, we've identified the players, but I want to stress that you should also remember that you have to identify what training needs you do in order to make sure that the job is done right, that the if you're involved with TNR, that the animals are not injured in any way because of an inexpertise in how to trap properly or an inability to understand some of the issues involved. You also want to make sure that when you do this, you have increased your efficiencies by training. I guess that's about it, since I'm going to be introducing Jim. Anyway, thank you all very much. It's been a pleasure.
Being a typical health director, I always have somebody else do my work for me. Thank you, Cheryl. I want to thank Jim Dale. He, as your leader, did what real leaders do. Debate like hell with me to justify my reason for having this before you. We had close to 2 months of exchange. He did what a leader does, puts everything on the table, coordinated back and forth, and gave us the opportunity for this dialogue. And Jim, you are a leader, and maybe someday you'll be president of this great association. And I just want to thank you. The other point, Jim, is that you being an Air Force officer, specifically, spoke to the points of these colonies being left behind. I see the captain in the back, and I welcome him. And I was at Fort Walton Beach just a year ago. And at that time, I couldn't believe the money of those estates, $3 to $5 million, and the only real population walking the streets at this time of the year were feral cats. To the point that the county was spending one-third of their budget on controlling the cat population, which is amazing. That's money that could have gone into senior programs, well, child clinics, and other. As a public health official, I myself said, what can we do? When I was a director of health, I had an overabundance of 13 colonies, and I said, I need help. And I went to an Esther Meckler, Esther, if you could please stand, with Spade USA. This woman saved my phone from ringing off the hook, and I could do my job as a public health officer. I then went back and I said, Esther, I got to cut your budget to 4. She cried a little bit. She came back and she said, we'll do what we can. The population dropped not just the 100% of what it was, but another 20% on top, and I thank you for that. As a health officer in Massachusetts, not just in Connecticut, we had a problem. If you all recall when the rabies issue through raccoons came about from dear old Pennsylvania, Potsdam, Pennsylvania, these little critters crossed the Delaware, just like George Washington. They crossed the Hudson, they crossed the Connecticut, but we stopped them at Cape Cod. Why? Because a coalition of thoughtful people, health officers working with caregivers who are all feral cat people, got together. And we said, how do you take care of your cats? And they said, we feed them, we know where they are, and we care for them. And what's the problem? Well, they know where the raccoons are. So we had some dialogue, as Cheryl talked about, and what did we do? We baited, vaccinated, and to this day, there's no rabies on Cape Cod because of a new program. Innovative. It's amazing they crossed the other major rivers and they actually went over the Mississippi in the other direction. I then was blessed to be in another community, Bridgeport, Connecticut, as a health director. When the West Nile virus hit, it was a lack of dialogue that caused the spread of that disease nationwide. Why? Because I was the first person to realize that the disease was being spread through the fowl population. I had a population of third graders walking through the zoo. We were just doing a zoo walk, and we're talking about health and the relationship between man and the animals. I was invited to be the point. And a little third grader said, "Hey, Mr. G, how come there's so many pretty birds dead?" What? Being an adult, we didn't realize it. There were 30 exotic birds down. Looked around, there were 4 crows down. So I talked to the caretaker and I said, "How often has this been happening?" He said, "You know, it's been happening for about a week." I said, "Who'd you report to?" "Well, our vet won't be here the next week, but hell, they're only birds." Called the state health department. It took a week to get them in line because of the cylinders and how we all work, unfortunately. And finally, we did the blood ceremony, found out that it was being carried, and we identified West Nile. We could have stopped in the state if we didn't have negative polarization taking place. And that's why I think a dialogue is so important. On top of that, we could go to the next slide. On top of that, we had impacts. Disease transmission. Well, we stopped the disease of rabies at the Cape Cod. We could stop the disease of rabies if we can control the population and vaccinate, which is the most concern. As Julie said, she's proved the vaccine works, and we get a bigger bang for our buck, so it's cost effective for us. The other is the environment. Our little furry friends tell us where there are public health problems. Complaints come from those locations, and they're our safeguard. I use them to tell me where my inspectors, who may be playing hooky, don't know where the problems are. Complaints come in, and I thank them because they're thanking me to alerting me on where there's a potential public health threat's going to develop, and we can solve that problem. When I was in Mississippi, and I want to thank the director from the state, I was put on the ground by Trent Lott, and we were doing body control and some other points, and out of that came the federal regulations specifically on pet care for the last hurricane, which was successful in Houston. And I'm glad to say that some of the dialect between myself and my state representative helped write that law. But it also gave me another issue. The caretakers, who are many of us in the area here, can help our mankind, which goes to the next point. What are public health's biggest concern right now as a health director? Reserve Corps. Hell, when I tied in with my animal control people, my caregivers, I picked up 13 nurses, 2 dentists, and a judge. My Reserve Corps was almost filled in one day. Why? Because of dialogue, participation, and connection. You got to realize these people have passion. They're out there doing the work 24 hours a day, many times, even in the winter. Middle of storm, I'm in Connecticut, snowstorm, 14 feet. They're out there feeding the cats. I'm saying, talk about passion. My God, that's what we need in public health. Community support, we have it all. It's partnership, it's linkages, it's groups like this. We're here in the West Coast, I'm from Connecticut. I got people from New Jersey. I got people from Florida. I got a health officer that I met that I talked to on the phone once, never even saw his face, and found him here today. It's how we get together in public health. We put the word public back in public health. And if we remember the pandemic of the Black Plague, it was our furry little friends that kept humanity alive. You cannot kill a cat in Germany or in London or Great Britain. Why? Because it was that population that controlled the disease-plagued rodents that saved humanity. So elimination 100% doesn't work. Why do we want that? We don't. We just want to control. And I think a successful program can do that. Why? It's cost effective. Saves me money for all my budgets for my pro-natal, prenatal, senior, dental clinics, and everything else. Why? Because in 2 years, statistically, and I did this in 3 different states as a health officer, my biggest complaints are animal related. And I had a headache, and I just wanted to get off of it. So I always passed the responsibility to somebody else, and they took care of it for me. And the mayor was happy, the legislators were happy, and I got my little bonus every year, and moved on after success was completed. It is humane to work together. Next slide, please. I ask you to return back to where you are with an open mind. Just like Cheryl Sly said, think about it. If we don't think, we're not going to have new perspective. The old way of doing things have changed. There's going to be a change in Washington, one way or the other. We know either party is going to get in, but there's going to be a change. Policy is going to change. Everything changes every single day. Even the seasons change. Why can't we change thought processes? Do the linkages that work. Think about it. Stick it together. And if it does stick to the wall, why not? Take the leadership role. Your leadership role is put to the table the people who disagree and do agree. Let them work it out. There will be a coalition that will bind together, balance together, and deliver. And you're going to save money. And that's what it's about. Involve your community and other leaders and do it on the positive side. What you do not want to do, as Julie said, go out and just clear a population. Why? Because the press is going to kill you. And as a health director, you don't want that. Because I'll tell you, your biggest headache in the morning, the local press turn around saying, why did you do that? How come this happened? Because they sell news, and news to them makes money, and money's related to passion or opinions. And last of all, begin a trial program. Why not? It's not going to hurt. It's going to save you money. Jim, thank you. Oh, one last thing. We have these CDs that were paid for by Tomahawk. It's a CD that shows you a cost-effective way of doing neutering. And what else, Esther? Okay. And they're free to you. And we have them here. And if you'd like to take a few back, you're welcome to them. Jim?
Well, thanks. I guess you own.
Oh, and eat the more food because it's paid for.
Well, thanks everybody for coming today. How many people actually had questions? Questions out there? Well, if you got questions, okay. How many people got to rush away besides me and Bill? So, if you got a question, I'm gonna be wild. I'm gonna entertain a couple, three questions. So, please. Did anybody, I didn't understand.
Is there a delivery method for an oral rating section?
There's nothing licensed right now, right, Julie?
Nothing for tax.
No, nothing for
tax. But there's
one kind of large vaccine program, and they can convert your
dollars.
All we need, Julie, is somebody to send $10 million down to Florida. Dr. Julie would be glad to take that, work with Rich Ford up in North Carolina State, and develop that vaccine probably. If they just give you 10 or 20 million, wouldn't you take that? See how nice she is? Yes, sir. Please state your name, too. Did everybody understand? The question was about, cat feces and sandboxes and fleas. Would anybody on the panel, I guess the two veterinarians on the panel want to comment about that, or anybody else? Toxoplasmosis is the issue, possibly flea-borne disease.
Small numbers of cats, and a non-lethal method might be the patient, maybe more appropriate.
Tom had a comment here.
I had a similar problem. The problem wasn't the cats. The problem was some of the youngsters were bringing food in or they were urinating. And what we simply did was ask them to clean their pits, what we call them pits, and we put a cover over them for two reasons. One, they would take the toys out and sanitize them because we didn't want the kids sneezing. The biggest spread of disease were hand-covered or feces from the children. If you go to some of these McDonald's, they used to have all these playlands, and no one's ever cleaned those little items, the toys. So removing from the cat, we went to the daycare center where we regulated in Connecticut. We had them tarp everything at the end of the day, take the toys in, sanitize them, and make sure that there was nothing in the box itself, turn the sand over in the morning. And therefore, there was no concern with the cats even coming in because there was no place for them to go. And the biggest concern was the toys, and as well as the red toys, the red balls with the tracks on them. And the other point was the food. And we regulated that they couldn't even eat in the playground. And that resolved the problem.
Okay.
My name is Katie Stetterow, and I'm a veterinarian and a resident and a Colorado. And I can see the theoretical risk of disease spread. I'm just wondering if there's ever been any reports or studies on actual zoonotic disease spread to local animals or to people in the community. And if there has, that'd be important information to know. If there hasn't, that'd be really important information to know. And
Julie, Gordon, Eric, anybody along the way?
No. If you look at that PowerPoint slide, there is one study about toxoplasma, the presence of cats in a dangerous residential neighborhood, and the incidence of toxoplasma is affected. So they found no correlation. That's the only study that I have.
Well, I thank everybody for. I thank everybody for coming today. What I wanted to do when Tom and I talked, it says, let's stir the pot, let's get people talking. I'm so pleased to hear about the comments across the panel about the need for dialogue. They had to figure out some kind of some answers. There's a lot of questions out there. So if we can start the dialogue today and in the future have more sessions on this. Just for the people who are newly coming into this, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and actually I'm not the chair of the Veterinary Public Health, I'm the program chair and the secretary of the Veterinary Public Health, but John Herbold in San Antonio, the chair of our special interest group here, had a full day sessions at the AVMA on this topic. But we need to keep talking. And so I will work with Tom next year to say that possibly in Philly next year we will have more discussion about this. We'll bring on more people to talk about disparate views. We'll push our civility and raise our heights to be like, no is not the answer. You know, just say no doesn't work either, does it? So we're going to take and get more dialogue here. And I want to thank you all for coming and thank Tom so much for putting together this panel and those who put the money up to take and get people here from all over the country. So good luck. Have a great rest of the conference, and I'll see you next year. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yeah, we forgot to say there's a nice booth off in the exhibit area. There's 2107. They're there to answer questions, to give you literature. They'll take donations for the Jim Dale Children Fund. I see Tom wants to make one more comment. By the way, anybody who knows a public health veterinarian looking for a job, I just got notification that Kentucky's looking for one. So tell your friends that Kentucky's looking for a state public health veterinarian. We just got interviews are starting for a new one in Colorado, so I'm pretty excited. So please get out the word.
I just want you all to know that we were honored also today to have Nancy Peterson from the U.S. Humane Society here, and Nancy Place, and their support, and a new friend of mine. And if he could stand up, because he's Mr. Big Guy, and Craig Nielsen. And Craig hails from this area. And if it wasn't for his coordination out here, I've been dumping on this poor guy for 3 days. And before that, it was 4 months. And he's a gentleman, a scholar, and I'll have him on my team anytime. Thank you for your day. Please eat some food. It's here.